Rickson, yes, it is true that the Malawi Electoral Commission has got the legal mandate. However, even the issue of referendum, it's the Malawi Electoral Commission that have the legal mandate to facilitate the issue of referendum. Everything will come to the Malawi Electoral Commission. And now this issue is important for us as a country to make a decision. The Malawi Electoral Commission is there because of the people of Malawi. The Malawi Electoral Commission is there to save the people of Malawi. So we, the people of Malawi, are saying before we go ahead with this, we must be able to sit down as a nation and to decide on how we are going to go about this. So the issue of governance is very important. It's extremely important to look at the issue of governance.
People are suggesting that the Malawi Electoral Commission will just ignore your letter because you don't have any basis for which you are petitioning them not to carry out a legal mandate.
You see, the next forward is going to be, we'll battle in the court of law. As the citizens, we have the powers, we have got the power, the constitution is there because of us. We, the people of Malawi, are the ones who crafted that constitution. And at the same time, we are the same people who can change the constitution. So if we crafted the constitution, we formulated the constitution, we can change it. So we're going to battle in the court of law.
Lusungu Simba Mwakwawa is the leader of the Federalism Institute. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Has social media improved your life, or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, plus 1-202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
Uganda's main opposition party, National Unity Platform, or NUP, says the fight against corruption should be thorough and holistic. It adds that no one should be spared in the effort to weed out graft in public institutions, irrespective of the person's closeness to power or societal status. The remarks come as some senior government officials are being investigated and others charged with corruption over allegations of involvement in the Karamoja iron sheet scandal. Critics say the government has yet to implement punitive measures to serve as a deterrent to graft. Supporters of the administration reject the criticism. They say the ongoing prosecution of senior public officials for corruption is proof that the government is committed to fighting wrongdoing. For more on the calls for the fight against corruption, I read Matthias Mpuga. He is the leader of the minority in Uganda's parliament.
Certainly, the NUP position is an anti-corruption position, and we are out to see how General Museveni touches and prosecutes some of his own, aware that many of them have gone away with it for a long time. Just that this scandal is not only really callous and the level of callousness on the part of those who stole the handshakes is unprecedented, because no government minister needs these handshakes. And as it turned out, many of them used the handshakes to really go and undertake personal projects, not community projects. So we are looking out to how many of the ministers mentioned, including members of parliament, are going to be prosecuted. Will it not be selective prosecution? As the case has been over time, that the big fish have gotten away with the runaway corruption in billions of shillings, and the small fish are normally caught.
Some people are suggesting from the NRM that it appears that the government is pushing ahead with the prosecution of those who were involved in the iron sheet scandal, and that the call by President Museveni for the prosecution of anybody who was involved is a call in the right direction, and that it appears the government is tightening up to ensure that corruption is nipped in the bud. What do you say to that?
I'm not yet convinced. It's not yet time to celebrate that the regime has finally woken up, because my sense is that General Museveni is himself embarrassed that this is coming up. And I'm advised by insiders that actually it's not Anshit alone. After the Anshit scandal, we're going to have the goat scandal, that even the goat that are meant for this community was stolen. So we're going to see what the follow-up will be on other scandals. He is aware that Parliament has sanctioned two ministers over related matters: the Minister of State for Lands, the civil government. The Minister for Luero was aligned and was adjudged as being corrupt by the anti-corruption court. You see the Minister and the government. So we're not yet about celebrate. Hopefully, Mr. Museveni is playing on the side of the government. But I want to see his follow-up on everyone, including those very close to him. His Prime Minister, his Vice President, and a host of other senior government officials, including the Minister of Finance and the Minister of State for Defense.
The report says that some ministers are returning the iron sheet so that it will go back to the people who it was initially intended to go for. Don't you think that this anti-corruption crusade is sending the right signal that anybody caught stealing or anybody caught committing financial malfeasance or public corruption should face the music to the full extent of the law?
Returning what is stolen is what is expected. Remember, in our agenda, the opposition, we said we would even set up a reparation commission for those who have been mentioned in the stealing from the taxpayer to pay back and be prosecuted. And if they are returning what has been stolen, they're not taking out the facts that they are thieves. They should be as such prosecuted for again engaging in this stealing. So returning does not wash away the facts that one has stolen. Unless one can prove that indeed they got the iron sheets and aware of source, and therefore they can be absolved of wrongdoing. Anything short of that, all should be treated as such.
Well, but some people are saying President Museveni should be praised for his recent statement that Ugandans should stop acts of corruption, should not engage themselves in the acts of corruption, and that he is walking the talk with this Karamoja prosecution and investigations. Your response to that?
The beauty is that there are so many other cases of corruption that we are following. We would like to see the behavior of General Museveni after some of his close allies have been mentioned in these corruption cases, whether he's going to follow up the very way with zeal he's following the Karamoja scandal. Anything short of that, you should again go back the same old story, selective prosecution, and of course going for the small fish. Once see what General Museveni is going to do to his Prime Minister and his Vice President, then we shall know that he's very serious about his anti-corruption talk.
Mathias Mpuuga is the leader of the minority in Uganda's parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, African Environmentalist Saturday joined the rest of the world in commemorating Earth Day, a day set aside to raise awareness of the effects of climate change while promoting practices that protect the environment. Beverly Indifoin is a Cameroonian environmental specialist and the founder of Game Changers, a youth-led movement in the Central African nation that champions fighting climate change. Indifoin recently visited our studios in Washington, D.C., where she sat down with my colleague Mike Hovey for an in-depth discussion on how Africa can contribute towards the global effort to preserve the planet.
So I always like to say Earth Day, every day is Earth Day. Earth Day is every day. So we just might put a special day to really recognize it that much, but every day should be Earth Day because we have the responsibility to protect this earth that we're in. It should be some sort of awareness raising for people who are beginning to forget that the environment is so precious that we have to protect. So it should be some sort of creating awareness, you know, creating the consciousness so people can be more environmentally friendly and more eco-conscious in their daily operations. And it needs everyone. It's not just about environmentalists or it's not just about climate experts to commemorate. It's everyone.
But while on Earth Day itself, the theme, invest in the planet.
We like removing so many things. We like to remove, you know, extra weight. We like to remove every other thing. But there's one thing that we don't want to remove, and that is carbon from the atmosphere, and which in itself, if we try to remove, could be a billion-dollar business, you know, sector. So I think that that is an investment that we are still to even make. It's a sector that we still have to invest in, and that is investing in the earth, investing in smart solutions, green solutions, investing in brilliant ideas that can help, you know, remove the carbon back from the atmosphere, and, you know, invest in other smart agriculture, invest in waste management schemes, and all the other tree planting as well, you know, because basically, I mean, trees, we're breathing because trees are. So cut off one tree, we're losing oxygen the other way. So we still have to invest more in this, because I think our investments in the past have been more in fossil fuels and all of that. But so that, again, says we have to stop investing in what is instead taking away our future, because we are trading the environment for fossil fuel benefits, which is ideally shouldn't be the case.
If we look at the continent wide, the youth are battling a barrage of challenges, and among them is unemployment.
Right.
For a young person who is really focused on, I want to make better my life, I want to get a job and better my family,
right,
why should they care about climate change?
One of the reasons why climate messages don't go down easily is because people have different concerns, more pressing and urgent concerns. Like, I want to wake up, I'm looking for what to eat, I'm trying to maybe get my kids to school. That's like, I need to get that done now and not be thinking of climate change. Like, people have other worries, and young people have unemployment worries. Like, I'm leaving, I'm graduating, where am I going next? That should be more of my concern than climate change. So usually, how I try to get young people to care, you know, about this, at the same time solving those other problems, is to be able to make them see the climate crisis as an opportunity. You know, think of it not as a climate crisis, but as a climate opportunity, where we can explore the areas where innovation can come in and create green jobs. That's why my organization is trying to launch what is called the Green Pitch Competition, where we would have young people pitch green business ideas, some sort of the Shark Tank idea, but focus on green entrepreneurs. So it would not just be ideas on paper, it would be ideas with a prototype, a proof of concept that can be scaled as a business. You know, you're solving an environmental problem and at the same time putting food on your table, so that, because, I mean, people argue that Africa is still struggling to fight poverty. We haven't got to the point of being able to, you know, fight climate change. So that's a very crucial point. How do we get young people to really care about climate when they have other pressing issues like that? So in our solution, approach to this, we try to solve those other concerns while solving this one, so that they now see, okay, so I can, you know, come up with a way in which we can recycle our waste, and that could be a machine that I can sell. You know, I'm cleaning up the environment and at the same time making some money. We can train them on how to maybe upcycle textile waste into flower pots. That way you're cleaning up the textile waste and at the same time you're making a business out of it, and that way you're creating more green jobs. It ripples out, and that way it gets them concerned because you're solving the other issues that they really care about.
Beverly Ndifoyin is a Cameroonian environmental specialist and the founder of Game Changers. She spoke with my colleague Mike Hovey from here in Washington. Tunisians celebrated Al Fitr Islamic holiday Eid al-Fitr marking the end of Ramadan with a number of Arab countries. Eid al-Fitr, or Little Eid, as it is called in Tunisia, is an occasion that children in particular look forward to, as it means new clothes, toys and gifts for them. Eid is also an opportunity for family reunions and a day to honor classic traditions. For viewers, Noura Hefaid has more from the town of Hammamet in Tunisia.
In the early hours of morning, crowds of worshippers rush to line up for the Eid al-Fitr prayer outside a mosque in the ancient coast town of Hammamet, about 67 kilometers from Tunis. The voices of the worshippers rise to mention the name of the God, so that the Eid prayer begins.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
After arriving at the mosque, the worshippers line up to continue praising Allah after performing the Eid prayer. And this Imam explains.
Worshippers listen to the Imam's sermon in the mosque, in which he renews the recommendation to have good manner and help the poor and orphans, and the need for solidarity among Tunisians at all times, not on religious occasion. And after the prayer, the worshippers exchange greetings. The adult gives the children an amount of money called al-idayah.
The value of the Eid gift usually varies according to the age of the child and the social status family. For teenagers, celebrating Eid al-Fitr is a solemn event and indispensable tradition, so the day is sacred and special. Dr. Monsef bin Abdel Jalil is a Tunisian professor of religion.
On the Eid, the first thing to be done by Tunisians, according to their tradition, is to visit the graves of their beloved ones, grandparents, parents, relatives, friends. They attend a communal prayer in the mosque to thank the Almighty for the powers plans He has given them during the month of Ramadan, and the remaining part of the day would be dedicated to visits, gatherings, during which we offer some presents to children. It is perceived as a day of happiness, it's a day of remembrance, and it's a day of aspiration as well, religious aspiration and social aspiration.
Another Eid tradition is offering sweets, which many families still insist on preparing at home. Shiraz Al-Jaziri is a Tunisian singer, Spanish teacher and wife who is preparing the treats for her family.
I am one of those who prepare Eid cakes at home. As you can see now, I'm preparing the Tunisian baklava. I put the dough leaves in the dish, stuff them with the nuts, then add honey over it when it is ripe.
Tunisian women are honored on Eid al-Fitr in recognition of their efforts for the month of Ramadan. Gibran Dawedi, a Tunisian tour guide, explain more about the custom.
Haq al-Milah, which means in English the salt rite. This tradition means that on the last day of Ramadan, and once the husband comes back to his house after the Eid break, his wife will prepare a cup of coffee for him, and obviously he has to put some gold and some jewelry inside of the cup as a reward for his wife. This tradition is becoming rare nowadays because of the economic crisis in our country, especially since the so-called Jasmine Revolution.
This particular custom, which was practiced by grandparents and parents, is fading away in light of the high price of gold and declining purchasing power due to inflation. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Noura Faiz in Tunis, Tunisia.
In Sudan, residents of the capital Khartoum are fleeing to other towns and cities where there are no reports of fighting. Viewers Michael Atit in the country tells my colleague John Tanza that the previous fighting around key sites in Khartoum subsided on Saturday. He also says most families in the city are still struggling to get food, water and medicine.
Some sound of guns and shelling at around downtown, but since up to this moment, the situation, there is no much sound anymore. It is calm. Antelope could be seen on the sky, you know, trying to patrol the town. And even the
military also are also patrolling the town. So we could say from the Far Eastern that it is a little bit calm. We don't know whether it is a response to the 72 hours of drones, or it is, you know, something else. We don't know what is happening exactly.
And who is in control of the city? Who is in control of the city?
It is very difficult to predict who is in control and who is in which place. Because within the downtown, you could hear the military talk about they are in control of certain areas. But then if you meet the people who are trying to escape without coming to outskirts, to Sabah, they will tell you along all the roads from downtown outside, all these RSF forces who are, at all the checkpoints. They are some positive stories even from the civilians that they help people, they try to show them, to guide them on the state road, and they tell you, okay, don't go this way, go the other way, no, like that. So these are the stories I'm getting from some eyewitnesses who actually try to make it out from the town, from the hotspot out to the suburb. So it is very difficult, as I said, to understand or to predict that who is in control in which place. But the RSF seems to be controlling major part of the outside of the town, and with a few who are inside, maybe around the military barracks or around the presidential palace, where the fighting is taking place.
When I spoke to you earlier this morning, you said you were lining up for bread. Could you talk to me about your experience getting bread this morning?
Yeah, it is not only my experience, it is the situation in general here. I actually went from 8:30 in the morning, and I came back just half an hour ago, like around 11:30 or to 12 midday. There are many people queuing for bread, for cooking gas, even though it is not even there, but trying to survive. People go out to look for food, to look for something they can support their families, support their dear ones. You could see people with the jerry can and buckets, going and knocking on other doors, looking for water. There is a hand pump nearby school. People are also queuing for that, trying to fetch water for the consumption, for the daily consumption, for cooking, washing, and other stuff like that. So that is the situation a bit outside the downtown, where people are trying to not to do. When I was at the queue, the bakery, there was also a huge influx of people traveling, getting into buses, getting into the private vehicles. You could just see people along the road carrying their bags, families with children, women. They are trying just to leave this town by all means, trying to seek safety to nearby town or nearby place.
Is there any statement as of today from the two parties?
Apart from the statement the military leader Al-Burhan gave on the eve of Eid al-Fitr, there is no other statement. I heard the General Himati speaking last night on Al Jazeera TV, where he was trying to justify why they have reached to this stage of the situation in the country. So he's asking people to bear with the situation, and as normally they also ask people to support them so that they are able to win this battle and all. So up to this moment, it is the weekend here, and there is no much statement, but the silence could mean they are adhering to the ceasefire they announced for the 3 days. And this is just the first day of the ceasefire, and we see what is going to happen tonight, what is going to happen tomorrow. We can't tell.
Michael Atit is VOA's reporter in Sudan. He spoke with my colleague John Tanza from the capital, Khartoum. Hey. Right now it's time for music from our African college.
DJ Salvo, and you tuned in to Nightline Africa on Voice of America, and you've just heard my brand new single titled Mtandazo. I hope you enjoyed.
My name is Divine Tembeng Mba from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothi. Stay tuned and don't change the dial.
About VOA Africa, music, sports, and news.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a dead person shall have all the sleep necessary. I'm your host, Peter Clothi, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.